Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always forget what I'm supposed to say at this point. Yes. The Personal Wealth Coach is not merely a riveting rainy day radio presentation. It is also the name of an investment advisory firm headquartered in Salado, Texas, that advises people on and manages wealth for people who have wealth to manage. And it's registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission as an investment advisor and all that other kind of stuff. And anything that we say on here is to be taken with at least one grain of salt and possibly three. It is not investment advice. It is educational. That was the intent of anything here. We don't give investment advice on the air. And let's see, there's something else I'm supposed to say here. Oh, yes, the sources that we use are generally considered reliable, but not warranted to be absolutely the truth. There could be fake news buried somewhere in things like the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and Financial Times and places like that. But we haven't found any lately, but that doesn't mean it might not be there. It's kind of like cockroaches.
Cockroaches, the media.
I think
that's a good correlation.
I just assume that we have cockroaches. I haven't seen any in a long time, but I assume that there's one somewhere hiding in the house and just comes out at night and I don't get to see it or something, because so often I've thought we were completely rid of cockroaches in various houses in which I've lived and discovered that lo and behold, 3 o'clock in the morning, flip the lights on in the kitchen and scuttling across the floor is a da-da-da-da cockroach. They're ubiquitous.
Fantastically so.
Yes.
All right.
So, telephone number to call in here if you would like. If today is the 26th of August, 2017, where you are and it's raining, and we're experiencing the mild fringes of a hurricane called Harvey, then you can give us a call in here at 773-1400. That's area code 254-773-1400.
And if it's still the same day, but you're not experiencing those fringes because you're in a state other than Texas, you can also call 254-773-1400. It's really hard geographically when we've got people all over. You just told them they can't call unless they're experiencing Harvey right now.
Well, I'm experiencing Harvey, so everyone else must be too.
Right. Well, that's a Jimmy Stewart concept, I think.
Yes, yes, yes. For them, Harvey exists. It's just invisible.
May not be a rabbit.
Right.
So what's happened this week?
Let's see. This week we had, depending on how you want to approach the week, we either had 5 or 7 days. Let's see what else happened this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was there, and so was the S&P 500, and they rallied. Not much, but they rallied. For those of you who haven't been following this riveting, exciting episodes, these episodes of weekly reports on the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 and things like that, the past 2 weeks, the S&P 500 dropped a total of about 1.9%. And that's sort of unusual because, it's extremely common, and B, it's extremely unusual, both at the same time. The reason I say that is historically in the summertime, the market goes down. And this summer, it hasn't gone down. As a matter of fact, it's up about 1.9 total for the last 3 months. The interesting thing about this year is instead of declining, it has risen slowly and steadily until the last 2 weeks, if we look at it week at a time. But this week, it reversed course and was up 0.72%. And that just tells you how mild and moderate market behavior it is when we talk about in an entire week, the market was up 0.72% for the week. And that's exciting.
It's very strange.
Markets rally.
A rally of 0.72%. 0.any percent, I wouldn't call a rally. But it's what the headlines are good.
Well,
last week it was Dow plummets 0.something%
yeah.
Plummet and rally. I think you're overusing maybe a little extra emphasis on the word.
It's kind of a traditional. It's the greatest, the most magnificent, the biggest in history. Everything is.
If you showed up to Weight Watchers and said, I've lost 0.76% of my body fat, nobody would clap.
Well,
nobody would say.
They're just a bunch of spoil sports.
I know. I plummeted off of my body.
You could come in there and say, this is the least I have weighed in 2 days.
Exactly. Breaking records here. Literally, there's a vinyl record in my hand right now. I just broke it. That's the only record I broke.
The downward movements in the market seem to coincide, whether there's a cause and effect there, but there's definitely a coincidence, seem to coincide with the increasing concern that traders are having that when the Congress reconvenes, they've got 12 working days.
Yeah, people are starting to get nervous about the budget and whether or not we have a government shutdown for the debt ceiling and things that may, mm-hmm. on any other given week, have some bearing.
Well, considering that we spent 6 months, Congress on one trying to pass a bill and couldn't. And historically, the budget and the debt ceiling are more controversial than even health care.
Mm-hmm.
And they got 12 days to do something. Now, the market's recovery this week from its huge slump of 1.9% bumped up when Mitch McConnell said, no, there's absolutely 100% chance that we will raise the debt ceiling. There's absolutely no chance in the world that we won't raise the debt ceiling.
And then got socked in the jaw when the president said, we're either going to get the wall or shuts down.
But then after the president said that if he doesn't get the wall in the budget, he'll shut the government down. But then Steve Mnuchin, who is the Secretary of the Treasury, says, there's no way in the world we're going to shut everything down. We're not going to do it. Steve is unaware of the fact that he doesn't get to sign the bill.
Right. This is the important piece in here, and something we don't cover. I realize that we covered a bit of it during the election, but we really don't dwell that much on politics. What we try to dwell on is the policy that comes out of politics. And occasionally we try to read the tea leaves. It's a lot harder to figure out what Congress is going to do than to figure out what the market's going to do, which says something, because if we could figure either of those out, we'd be too wealthy to be on the radio right now.
Well, the good news is, year to date, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is up 9.12%. And from a year ago, it's up 12.63%. Now, don't expect that kind of return to go on much longer. It could, but those are what we call, at least I call, I presume you call it too, recovery returns. In other words, when the market has been below its normal level of growth for an extended period of time, and by extended period of time, it's been a long time. It's been almost a decade now. The stock market has been undervalued dramatically ever since it started falling. About 10 years ago, it peaked, and then it started downhill and got to amazingly low levels, which, of course, terrifies everybody when they should be coming in and buying and getting excited. But then the market has been recovering ever since. And now, at least according to – this is Jeff speaking – at least according to my calculations, I have this trend line that I've run. It's now 40 years I've been running this trend line. And if you pull all
– have you been running the trend line for 40 years, or does the trend line go back 40 years? Because that seems like a really long project.
It is. It has been a long project. I've run a trend line with 40 years worth of data.
Okay, there you go.
And actually, I've been running the trend line for most of that 40 years. But the – because I'm really old. But the point is that – I was looking for a pattern, and I love to find patterns, and they're kind of fascinating. And if you take inflation out of the stock market, in other words, you take the consumer price index every month and you subtract it from the return of the stock market,
right?
The monthly consumer price index, then you get a different picture of the, for example, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index than you do if you allow inflation to inflate the numbers and make them look silly. And when you do that and you put this on what we call a logarithmic scale, which turns a curve, a compound interest is a curve, it turns it into a straight line. So if you have a constant interest rate on a in compound interest and it's constant, then on a logarithmic scale, it would show as a straight line. So then I plot this straight line over the top of the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index for the last 40 years. And it spends most of the time looking at it from a four-decade perspective, which makes the bumps look smaller. It spends most of the time tracking right along that line. Now, every once in a while, it'll do something strange, like it did in 1994 when Alan Greenspan said, "How do you know when there's a fundamental change in economics, or if it's just irrational exuberance?" I love irrational exuberance. And it took off and it headed away from the trend line enthusiastically. And towards the end of the 1990s, people say it's different this time. Something fundamental has changed. We're in a different world. The digitalization of everything and the tech of everything has caused things to be different. And so it's okay that the stock market is running at an absurdly high growth rate compared with history. And then it promptly plunged right back down to the trend line.
Right.
But what we were missing is something called reversion. In other words, if it's going to run above the trend line for a while, it puts kind of a mountain on the trend line.
It's got to have the negative side that goes with that.
The way the universe works, there's going to be a dip in there someplace below the trend line that's going to have the same value as the mountain above the trend line, so it'll all balance out. And sure enough, in 2007, the dip started, and it bottomed out in 2009, and now we're back to the trend line. So what's the trend line? The trend line is 7.7%. 7.69 to be exact, on the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, and that's with inflation taken out. So if we got inflation running along about 1.something% a year, then it's reasonable to expect that over the long term, based on history, now there's no guarantees here, but it's reasonable to look at maybe an 8% return over the long term. And of course, then I'm going on in a monologue here, but let me stick a caveat in there. Had you invested in the year 2000 at the top of the market, your average annual rate of return after subtracting inflation from then till now would be 0.39% a year. So there are periods of time when you don't get 8% or 7% or
right.
Anything like that.
And it has to do with if you jump in at the top of a market, it's going to take a lot longer to recover. And that is there's a lot of data points that I want to throw in during this program, housing sales and all that good stuff.
Point.
But I am getting, I got this week 4 questions about Bitcoin.
Oh, yes.
From people who don't know what it is to people that are involved in the tech world, but still don't know what it is. There only been a couple of people that have been fairly well versed on what a Bitcoin is. And when I ask a couple of very key questions, their eyes get really wide and they go, "Oh, so
it's a number.
It's a Bitcoin is not just, no, it's not a number. I mean, that's like,
it's a prime number, isn't it?
No. It's one way of trying to understand it. It is a factor, an algorithm that factors and does use prime numbers in the factor to create a private and public key for communication. It's an encryption, a cryptocurrency. One-time use keys with a limit on the number of them that can be created by another algorithm, and that says that there can only ever be 21 million bitcoins. So it's got scarcity, and it's got some kind of something that it can be used for. Here's the thing. It's using a 256-bit encryption, which I realize when people say, what are you talking about? Well, just think of 256 digits. But the digits can only be a 0 or a 1. It's still a really long number, and it's hard to crack. But if technology comes along nicely, as it has been, then eventually that cryptography will be crackable. Anybody with a watch in 10 years will be able to crack that, most likely. So there's a death expectancy for the value of the Bitcoin, in that once that cryptography no longer works, then it's no longer a cryptocurrency. It's just a number, as you said. And that's not technically correct. It's a factoring of numbers. It's a more complicated thing than just saying a number, but not overly so. Bitcoin right now, and the reason why I said it's a good segue, Bitcoin right now is very, very high in value. It's somewhere around $4,300 a Bitcoin, and it's come up by more than 400% in the past 12 months. Well, that sounds like a really amazing thing, except that people that buy something because it's going up tend to sell it because it's going down, which is the opposite of what you should be doing, which is buying low, not high, and selling high, not low. So keep that in mind. And Bitcoin is a gamble. It is a pure gamble because the use of that key would make it non-functional. And if that key, that cryptography, that ability to put security on a single communication were really worth that, it would be way too expensive to log on to your bank accounts online. They use 256-bit encryption, sometimes 512-bit encryption, when you log into any secure financial institution online, and they do it for free, not $4,300.
One of the things about Bitcoins that has not made the headlines, but it would if they were stocks, is that on June 11th of this year, an individual Bitcoin, at least reportedly, was selling for a little over $3,000.
Right. Now it's roughly 4,260, 4,260, somewhere right in there.
But on July 16th, it was below $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
So what we had is, in just over a month, we had a one-third drop in the price of Bitcoins. And here's the biggie to me. Nobody knows why.
That's not true.
Really?
There's a really, really nice and easy to find correlation. This will be great. Yeah. This is very much like
obviously a lot of people were selling Bitcoins at that point.
Well, cold weather tends to cause the price of petroleum products to go up, particularly heating oil. Okay. So just keep that in mind. If you're not looking at the weather, if you're only looking at the trend line and the prices, you say, this doesn't make any sense. Why does it keep having these weird actions? Do a search on Chinese government shuts down Bitcoin marketplace. And what you'll find is that every time the Chinese government finds and shuts down two or three Bitcoin marketplaces, you get this massive dip in the price of Bitcoins. Because what's going on is that Chinese people with lots of money are trying to get their money out of China. They're buying Bitcoins, and then they're selling the Bitcoins for dollars. So now they no longer have yuans in hand, they have dollars in hand. They have the value of the American dollar out there. So there is a very fast turnaround, and you can see this by looking at the blockchain, which is a nice way of tracking the volume of sales and purchases of the Bitcoin. What happens is that the volume of sale, when people have a Bitcoin, they tend to turn around and sell it fairly quickly on average. But the volume of purchase is also usually pretty steady, in that people are buying Bitcoins in huge amounts, generally speaking, in China. There are a lot of Americans that are getting on board as well, but the majority of it's coming from China, and you can watch that, because when those sites get shut down in China, the purchase pressure drops. Nobody's buying all of a sudden. All of this money that was coming into Bitcoin suddenly stops. And people are still selling it at the same rate that they were before. So the price drops. And if you, there's a really great, I need to make a graph of it just so that how easy it is to correlate the two. There's a headline, Chinese government shuts down Bitcoin marketplace. You can bet that within a few minutes, the Bitcoin price is going to start dropping very, very rapidly. You can also bet that as soon as a new Bitcoin marketplace opens up in China, you're going to have a gradual rise again until everybody in China kind of figures out how to do it, and then it jumps back up to that crazy growth rate. So what you're really you're betting against in a Bitcoin is the Chinese government's efficiency in finding and shutting down Bitcoin marketplace. And they have the ability, if they really get serious about it, of being 100% efficient there. So that's what you're betting against, besides the fact that the technology is dated. And if we get the kind of increase in computing power that comes from a quantum computer or an optical computer, then the cryptography in a Bitcoin becomes absolutely worthless, which causes the Bitcoin to be worthless. And that's another thing that you can Google when people have shared the private key in exuberance over having discovered a Bitcoin, or exuberance over finding the block that a Bitcoin exists in, or as a gift to a friend, they make a big picture of both keys. Well, the Bitcoin becomes absolutely worthless at that point. So the cryptography section of the cryptocurrency is important. And then here's the final part, and one that I think is more important than any of the others, because people like to gamble. If you're going to gamble, Vegas, Bitcoin, if you're going to gamble and you know it's a gamble, that's fine. But the IRS wants their piece. They want a piece of the winnings. And if you're not keeping great records, you're going to get in trouble. Nobody's going to send you a 1099 on this. There's no financial organization that's obligated by law to send you a tax form. But if you get audited and you have purchased a Bitcoin and then sold it at a later date, you better keep records of what you bought it for and what you sold it for, and you better pay taxes on it. And you don't get to pay taxes at capital gains rate. It's been regulated as a commodity. And commodities have a whole series of different kinds of tax rates about it. So keep that in mind. This is a complex area. It is, by about any measurement you want to give it, in a price bubble. Does that mean it will immediately stop going up? No. I said last month, people shouldn't buy this. And since then, it's up another, 150%?
I think there is also a correlation between the rise in Bitcoin and a guy named Doug Casey.
Who's Doug Casey?
I have received several people ask me about Doug Casey and whether they should convert all of their wealth into Bitcoins because of the Fed dollar.
Oh, I don't know what this...
You haven't heard about... The Fed coin.
What is the Fed coin?
Well, let me
all coins.
Let me read you what's called, and they're all over, and they get sent by email.
A conspiracy chain email, then.
So. Well, it's not just a conspiracy chain email. Apparently, it's been on television. It's called an advertorial.
Oh, an advertorial, not a documentary. An advertorial.
It's an advertorial. But let me read you a line from it. It involves the U.S. dollar and a controversial new law the Federal Reserve may be forced to enact.
The Federal Reserve cannot enact laws.
I thought you would pick up on that very quickly.
The Federal Reserve is a bank. Steve Mnuchin signing a bill. It doesn't work that way. He signs a dollar bill.
There is, by the way, that's one of the things that Doug Casey is using as a proof that the United States dollar will soon become worthless, so you should buy Bitcoins.
Because it's been signed by someone?
It's not been signed by the current Secretary of the Treasury.
That's because they haven't issued the new...
That's beside the point. It's invalid. All the money, according to him, is invalid because the current Secretary of the Treasury has to sign all money, and the current Secretary of the Treasury hasn't signed any money yet. Therefore, all money, all dollars are invalid.
That's kind of like saying all treaties are invalid as soon as a new president's elected.
I am just telling you what the argument is that he's presenting.
All right.
And that there will be a $1 trillion Fed coin issued by the Fed.
A single coin?
A single coin.
That's worth $1 trillion?
It's made out of platinum.
Wow, don't lose that coin.
Actually, it's based – there's always a little nugget of truth. It's something called the big lie, and it comes from Mein Kampf. If you say it loud enough and long enough and boldly enough and never apologize, and there is a tiny nugget of truth in it someplace, then the big lie becomes accepted as truth.
Right.
And in this case, there was some discussion among economists of monetarizing the United States debt by issuing a single coin.
Uh-huh.
And the United States simply declares this coin is worth $1 trillion.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, the Treasury has a lot more money than it used to have.
that's been done by lots and lots and lots of countries,
and
not
then,
something that we intended to, because it would cause the inflation rate to go to 1,000% overnight.
Among other things, it's completely against the law in the United States to do such a thing. But that's beside the point. It's been discussed by some not too deeply thinking journalist economics types. And as a result, that is the nugget of truth. Yes, it was discussed. Now, the Federal Reserve could not issue such a coin.
No, it would have to be.
But it's called the Fed coin because it is assumed that the Federal Reserve will issue $1 trillion coin and thereby
don't
dilute.
Spend it all in one place. Can I break this coin? No.
Get rid of all the U.S. debt at one fell swoop. It really doesn't make a lot of sense to do that, to what I just said. There's nothing about that that makes any sense.
No.
But because it is said with such confidence and such mystery.
And people don't understand
the secret, and he's making claims about a secret meeting of the Fed where they're about to devalue all dollars by 1 to 100.
Well, if they – see, there's a problem with that in that the Federal Reserve Act gives the mandate to essentially not do that.
You got it.
That's their primary thing. Don't do that.
How many people besides you and me have read the Federal Reserve Act?
I guess not very many.
The bottom line to it is there's a guy out there who is – the nicest thing I can say about him is he's a charlatan.
Is that like Charlemagne?
No. It's far worse.
Oh, okay.
It's a person who spouts a bunch of lies with the intent of enriching himself at your expense.
And he's doing it.
He is doing a very good job of selling bitcoins to people, getting them to convert their wealth into bitcoins so that he can have their wealth and they can have some bitcoins. And the fact that this buying pressure on the bitcoin is so intense is because of that issue. It's kind of like a few years ago, gold was the big issue. Now it's bitcoin.
Right.
And it's the same people in general who are trying to sell them. And anybody who wants to sell them that badly, if they're really going to appreciate that much, why are they so interested in selling them?
Right. This is kind of the most fundamental and the easiest way to understand this, period. If you want to make a profit, you can make a profit gambling. There's no doubt about that. A lot of people make profits gambling. The casinos make lots of money gambling. They make a lot more money than the gamblers make. You have to recognize it's gambling, and you have to recognize that you have the ability of losing a lot of money. If you want to have a good and reasonable expectation of profit, it's a very different thing. It means that you should be adding value with your purchase. If you buy a Bitcoin or a gold coin today, and you don't do anything to that gold coin or that Bitcoin, and you expect to sell it for more money, you're missing a piece of the equation. It means somebody's got to have to be willing to pay more for it than you paid for it without having had any extra benefit for it.
And there's another thing that's important, and that is, why are bitcoins worth anything?
It's a really good question, and it's the same reason that cowrie shells were worth something, because a group of people said, I will trade these for that, and there's a large enough community of people saying, I will trade bitcoins for value, that there is a market for you, but it's something that we in the stock market would call thinly traded. And which means there's not a large enough community that if even 5% of the people with Bitcoins decided to sell today, it would cause the Bitcoin value to drop drastically.
And I don't claim to understand the Bitcoin market.
Just as a side note, when money in circulation right now is somewhere between 2 and 5%, and money in circulation doesn't mean paper money. It means money that's moving around. That's being bought and sold on any given day is between 2 and 5%. If that number were used with bitcoins, you would have the price of bitcoin drop down to near $100 from $4,200.
I don't make any claim to understand the depths of the bitcoin market because much of it is – well, one of the reasons it is given value by some people is it's extremely secretive. and you don't know theoretically who is that you're getting the money from or where the money is going, and it can't be traced theoretically.
Well, you can trace that it was owned by someone and that it was owned by someone before that. Everybody can see that in the blockchain, but who it is is anonymized.
That's, and my point is that apparently, according to the article that I read a little while back in the Wall Street Journal, probably the majority of Bitcoin transactions are illicit, meaning that they are done with the intent of avoiding taxes or avoiding some governmental restriction,
whether that be China or
money
the
laundering
States.
Or right. whatever. The reason that there has not been a thorough crackdown on Bitcoin is because there is so little volume in Bitcoin transactions that the regular money laundering transactions are big enough that the government chooses to chase after them. So if you buy a Bitcoin or if you sell a Bitcoin, there is a distinct possibility. I'm not saying that there's any certainty. I'm just saying based on the articles that I've read, there's this, a distinct possibility you are participating in an illicit financial transaction. And if, and I would go so far as to say when, the various governments around the world start to take this really seriously, you could suddenly find that you have just helped money launder some drug money. And as there's some pretty strict laws on that. And the very least that's going to happen is you lose any money that you made.
If we go out and measure the market for Bitcoin, there's just over 17 million Bitcoins in existence right now. There's a cap of 21 million.
Right.
It's roughly worth $4,200. If we were to say the same way we do to Google or Facebook or any other publicly traded company, which Bitcoin is obviously not, but if we were looking at the market size, how much the market has given in value to this company or that company, we call that market capitalization. You take all the shares that are out there times the current share price. That makes the market for Bitcoin about $71 billion. Except that if even 3 to 5% of that market tried to sell today, the market would drop drastically there. Part of the reason why the price is so high is because the few buyers that are coming in, there's new Bitcoins being made, but they're not being made very quickly. There's a lot more new buyers coming in than there are new Bitcoins, and they're willing to pay more and more for it until they're not. And that's the deal when the Chinese Bitcoin marketplaces go offline. A section of that took place back in March. Another time period of that took place back in May, where Bitcoin exchanges were shut down in China, and it caused the Bitcoin market to free fall for a while. And you can probably pull up some charts on that. That's anyway, I wanted to say that in that what you didn't hear us say is don't buy it. If you are going to buy it, know that you could lose all of the money. If it's still something you want to gamble on, because if you look at the trend line, it's a really positive trend line, just know the risks. If you're willing to lose the money or gain money, if it's like Vegas money to you, then it's fine. But the people that have been asking me about Bitcoin this week are not Vegas type people. These are people that are looking around and they're saying, I'm not getting very much interest rate at the bank. Should I buy a Bitcoin? And that question makes me want to put my head very firmly through a wall, because the bank is an extremely safe location with FDIC insurance. If the bank were to fail, up to $250,000 of your money is covered. You're in good shape. It's safe. Bitcoin, it's about the opposite of safe. There is no degree to which we could say it could go to zero. There's no way you could say there's no risk involved in this. And I had someone tell me Bitcoin has been a stable holder of value. And I said, what is your definition of the word stable? Well, maybe if you're talking about a place with wild broncos in stalls, that might be a stable, but it's not very stable.
The other thing about Bitcoin, there is absolutely no certainty that it will remain in existence as we know it today. For example,
It just went through a change. Yeah.
A new digital coin just came out called Filecoin on August 12th.
There's about 12 cryptocurrencies at the moment.
Within the first hour, it had sold $187 million worth of Filecoins, which are basically, you get to start all over again as if you were starting from zero with Bitcoin. Only the point is there is no limit to the number of new cryptocurrencies that can come out.
Right.
No one regulates them.
Even if you've got, there's a limit of 21 million Bitcoins, there's no limit to the others. And what's more, there's Bitcoin Cash, which was just issued by about half of the Bitcoin marketplaces. So the standard is breaking for Bitcoin. I think we kind of trounce down the Bitcoin enough to let people know it's a gamble. You can make money gambling, but most people lose money. The vast majority of gamblers lose money. Bitcoin marketplaces make money because they're not actually owning the Bitcoin. They are transferring the Bitcoin from one place to another. With the blockchain, they're not making huge amounts of money, but it still exists.
Speaking, let me touch on the I started to earlier. Let me touch on the potential for a government shutdown.
Okay.
Historically, we can go back to Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was the first president in recent history to shut the government down. He did so by vetoing the budget, and in the budget was the everything that we talk about, the debt ceiling increase and everything else, was all wrapped up in the budget. And there has to be a budget to increase the debt ceiling. When he basically, the Congress included a nuclear aircraft carrier in it, and he didn't want it, so he vetoed it and shut the government down. That was the worst market drop, because it was the first one. And the market dropped 4.4% and recovered in a week. So as we approach a potential government shutdown, with admittedly certain negative long-term implications for the reliability of the United States government, just be aware that anything that happens in the stock market is probably going to be very short-lived and very mild. Now, if by some amazing, unbelievable series of events the government stayed shut down, that'd be a different issue. But generally speaking, these things, as soon as the outcry comes up that the service members are not getting paid, Social Security recipients are not getting their checks, Medicare recipients are not getting paid, government employees are not getting paid, for some reason or other, Congress and or the president changes their mind and suddenly reverses course and restarts the government again. And to me, that seems a little bit silly, but if it does happen, that's the way it's probably going to happen.
Makes sense. And Ford did a government shutdown as well. He vetoed a funding bill for Department of Labor and Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which doesn't exist anymore. That was the Hue Department.
But it was just part of the government, though, whereas Jimmy Carter basically did the same, the equivalent of what Congress did in 2011, which is up.
Nope.
You can't spend
shutting
any more
money. I don't want that boat, is what he said.
And it only took about 3 days for him to change his mind.
Right.
So, it is.
And the employees weren't furloughed during that time period. No. It wasn't as big a shutdown as some of the others that have happened.
The 2011 shutdown, we actually had service members across the world that weren't getting paid. And we had a lot of unpleasant things happened for a very short period of time. And I realize that, among other things, our representative, John Carter, has said he sponsored a bill that says even if the budget ceiling doesn't get raised, the service members will get paid and the bill passed. But the problem is that bill can't override the fact that the Treasury doesn't have any money. If
said, right.
You will pay them if you pay nobody else. Well,
here's the problem.
Steve Mnuchin has said,
right,
we're not going to pay anybody. We're not going to prioritize.
Let me take a step back and say what's traditionally the role of Congress. Congress has the purse strings, as it were. They have the purse strings. Okay. Well, I don't know what strings have to do with it, but they control spending.
They can close the purse.
Right. The Congress has the ability. House of Representatives, all spending bills have to originate there. They have to come up, be approved by the Senate, go back and forth. Then the president has to say, yep, if it's large enough to override a veto, or not, so on. So this is how spending happens. Traditionally, way back when the government was first founded, and all the way up till not horribly long ago, the Congress would pass a law that would say we're going to spend this much money, and pass a sister law or brother law, depending on whether you prefer sisters or brothers, that says this is going to, we don't have enough money from taxes to pay for this, so we're going to have to borrow some money. This law authorizes the issuing of this much money's worth of bonds. They got tired of passing two laws instead of one law all the time. So they passed a big law that said to the executive branch, to the Treasury Department, you issue the bonds when we say spend money. But let us know when we've gone to the point where we said, remind us. That's what the debt ceiling is. So they said to the Treasury Department, we're going to spend money. You pay for it, either borrow it or get the tax revenue. And when we've borrowed enough money, let us know and we'll raise the debt ceiling again because we're the ones passing the spending bill. In essence, they have handed the responsibility for the debt of their own spending to someone else, but it's not really handing the responsibility to someone else. The analogy I love to use is if you go to a restaurant and you buy the nicest dinner and you eat it and you love it, it's amazing. The waiter comes and says, here's the bill. And you say, no, I've decided I don't want any more credit card bills, so I'm not going to pay for this. You ordered the menu from the menu, knowing the price. That means you should pay for it. If you've got to fix the budget, fix the budget. And that's kind of the underlying factor.
But it's
there.
kind of it's a little closer, I think, to say that you did go out and have a lot of meals and you took a lot of vacations and you bought cars and you bought things. And you've got this big credit card bill. And when the bill comes, you say, no, I'm cutting my – I want to cut spending. Therefore, I'm not going to pay my credit card bill.
The Treasury Department doesn't have the ability to say to Congress, I'm going to pay for this and not that. They have some priorities, but those priorities were given by Congress to the Treasury Department. So they have to follow those priorities. If Congress says you've got to pay the military when you run out of money, that's kind of like saying you've got to learn how to fly. Here, have a feather. Physics says you can't do it that way, even if you have big enough ears.
It worked with Dumbo.
It worked with Dumbo. And fiscal policy says that you can't spend money you don't have unless you're borrowing. If you're not allowed to borrow, you can't spend it.
Do we have any commercials
to do. We've got a very few commercials, but we will play them right now if that's all right.
All right. Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. You're welcome to give us a call in here on the other side, 254-773-1400. And
we'll be back.
And now, a message.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number to call in here, 254-773-1400. And my guess is everybody is so busy watching the rain.
Yes, there's wet stuff falling from the sky. I'd rather watch the wet stuff than call two bald guys.
That could be it. Hey, the euro is above $1.19.
Wow. When you think back to the beginning of the year when they were very close to the same.
Right, it was $1.04.
$1.04 to a euro.
And you could see that from a negative point of view and saying, oh, no, the dollar is down against the euro or the euro is up against the dollar.
You'll hear us clapping. That means our exports just got cheaper to everybody else.
Yeah, we basically just did. I know this is not exact, but it's pretty close. We basically just did a 19% discount on all U.S. goods sold overseas against those sold in Europe. And apparently the folks in Europe are very, very unhappy, the economists and those, the central bankers and so on, about the fact that the euro keeps rising. And from all that I have read on the subject, the primary person, he's doing a wonderful job of helping U.S. exporters is Donald Trump. Apparently, there is a high correlation between him doing something that the Europeans are relatively unhappy about and the rest of the world is very unhappy about, and they sell dollars and buy euros, which you got to admit is a big plus for exporters, because the more he talks the dollar down and convinces people that he's going to shut the government down and things like that outside of the United States, the further the dollar falls. And the further the dollar falls, the cheaper Caterpillar equipment gets when they sell it overseas and they still make a profit here. So that's cool, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
sort of.
Kind of on that subject, the Atlanta Fed, and why it's kind of on that subject, is the difference between imports and exports impacts our GDP. And the Atlanta Fed does something they call GDP Now. It's a model that's supposed to be used to predict the GDP of the United States. And they published the data. They're predicting a 3.4% third quarter, which is not that different than what a lot of the consensus out there is. So that's good news on the horizon as far as this quarter looks to be doing fairly well. One bit of news I wanted to throw out there. You mentioned this in passing. It's in the newsletter. July home sales fell 9.4%.
That's just what I was looking at here in front of me.
The new orders for durable goods declined 6.8% in July. Yeah. Existing home sales declined 1.3%. Now, those headlines sound very drastic, and they are definitely negative. But when you dig into the report, which we do with a fork and a knife and a nice
napkin
shoved into our shirts so that we don't get pieces of the report all over our shirt as we consume it, what you find is that last year in July was the biggest increase in home sales that we've seen in huge periods of time. So this would be one of those reasons for a good record-breaking comment. Which means that if we didn't have a huge jump in sales to correlate this year, then we're going to have a drop. And that's just the way you look at it. There's also issues with not enough people being employed to create the new homes. We've run out of inventory of new homes very, very, very quickly. And they're basically selling as soon as they come on the market. There was a little glut of new homes that all sold at once in July of last year. So the year over year numbers, a 9.4% drop is one of those that in economics, you see a drop like that and you go, what's going on there? Well, and go ahead.
I was on the same subject.
Yeah.
The 25-year average sales of homes in the United States are 727,000. So that's the average number of homes sold per year over the last 25 years. The annualized read now, based on what we've seen so far this year, is 571,000. So we're running roughly a third below normal home sales in the United States, and there's no simple reason for that, but there's some good complex series of reasons.
Yeah, household formation, ability to get a new loan, interest rates being unprofitable for banks. There's a lot of reasons that all come together to say it's harder to buy a home today than it was 10 years ago.
It's harder to buy a home. There's more sensitivity to the ability to pay for it once you do buy the home.
Well, that's amazing. They actually want you to pay for the home that you bought.
And there's a lot of people.
Somebody should tell that to Congress.
Who have heard the horror stories of people who got stuck in houses when the industry moved someplace else. But there's another reason too, and that is the low-end house. Now, this was astonishing to me when I saw
Not the low end of the house, because that means that the foundation needs to be leveled if there's a low end.
The median, what's called low-end starter house in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what the average, the median price is for those?
I can make a guess, somewhere around $200,000.
$300,000.
Well, that could be an issue. My first house is $300,000. No, that's a problem.
And those are considered low end starter houses up to $300,000. Now, there's obviously lower. You can buy a mobile home, which is now called a manufactured house or something like that.
A manufactured house with wheels.
Yes. Well, they take the wheels off of it before they sell it.
Then it shouldn't be called a mobile home anymore. Anyway,
I realize that, but still, whatever.
Unless you're going to drag it on a sled.
But the problem is, I think people are starting to figure. At least they're beginning to figure out. Hopefully, they have figured out that those things don't appreciate; they depreciate.
Right.
But the issue is that we are unable to build enough houses in the United States to match new family formation in the United States, household formation. So the household doesn't hold a house anymore. Mostly it's going into rental properties.
So it's a house unhold.
Right. There's still a lot of, and it, this is still a little astonishing, but I've seen it happen firsthand. There are a lot of married couples with children living with their parents right now.
Or renting.
Even the renters are topping out right now because the rental prices have become so high in the places where there's good jobs that
just live with your parents.
Just live with your parents for a little longer. And so, there is a key element in this, in addition to the psychological elements, which we'll get through, and even the financial elements, which we can get through. One of the reasons that new houses are so expensive is because there is a critical shortage of labor to build houses, a critical shortage in the United States.
It's very, very difficult to get even in Central Texas, where it's not anywhere near as bad as elsewhere, there's typically a 2 to 4 week wait for a plumber or an electrician. And we're about out of time for this hour. We will be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll talk more about the exciting and fun conversation on topics like new orders for durable goods declining.
Yeah, we'll talk about why they declined when they really didn't decline. They actually didn't decline.
And I'm sure everyone out there is cheering.
And the Purchasing Manager Index is up.
The most exciting conversation.
Even though the durable goods orders declined.
We'll talk about a record that did get hit this week. It's the longest stretch since 2004 of fill in the blank. We'll leave suspense out there. And people go, oh, I want to hear what the record is. So if you'd like to contact us off the air, we'll be back next hour. But if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekend locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, listen to podcasts, and so on. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.